This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 16th of May, these are our main stories. Britain becomes the latest Western country to pledge more military aid to Ukraine after a surprise visit by Volodymyr Zelensky as part of a tour that took in Rome, Berlin and Paris. A long-awaited report strongly criticises the FBI for the way it investigated ties between Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and Russia. EU regulators approve the most valuable deal in gaming history, but Microsoft's takeover of Activision Blizzard still faces other hurdles. Also in this podcast...
I'm looking at her on the social media feed. I can see her in her apron behind the counter. She's been going for 96 hours.
She's currently dancing and singing.
After cooking non-stop for 4 days and nights, will a Nigerian chef get her just desserts and win the world record for a cookathon? Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has become the latest European leader to pledge more weapons to Ukraine as Volodymyr Zelensky visited the UK after stops in Italy, Germany and France. On Monday, the two men held 2 hours of talks at Mr. Sunak's country residence, Chequers, with the British Prime Minister tweeting a picture of the two leaders hugging in front of the helicopter Mr. Zelensky flew in on. Britain is to send hundreds of air defence missiles and armed drones to Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky praised the outcome of his whirlwind tour of Western European allies, which, as well as securing a $3 billion military aid package from Germany, includes training for Ukrainian pilots on Western fighter planes, although not the jets themselves.
We are returning home with more defense packages, with newer and stronger weapons for the front line. It signifies a better defense for our people and more political support.
Our security correspondent Frank Gardner told us more about the meeting between the British and Ukrainian leaders.
Well, President Zelensky didn't get everything that he asked for. I think there is always going to be a gap between his military wish list, his shopping list, as it were, and what NATO countries are prepared to give him. You know, he aims very high, but bit by bit, incrementally, he has been getting over the months much of what he's asked for: tanks, drones, air defence systems, anti-tank weapons. But combat aircraft seems to be one area that the West is dragging its feet over. For a start, Ukraine wants F-16s, and Britain doesn't have any F-16s. It's offered to help train pilots on them, but it hasn't got them to give. And a number of other countries have got them, but there is some reluctance, as for various reasons. It's going to take months to train the pilots. You've got to have a whole logistics tail that supports them: maintenance, petrol, oil, lubricants. You've got to build runways that will take them. You've got to protect them, etc. But what he has got out of today's meeting with the Prime Minister in Britain is this promise of sending attack drones as well as air defence systems. And the attack drones are really important because this will help Ukraine shape the battlefield prior to its offensive. Ukraine will want to try and degrade Russia's rear defensive areas as much as possible to hit its supply lines, its command and control centres, its ammunition depots, all the things that sustain the front lines of the battlefield. If it can do that successfully, then it will make it very hard for Russia to keep fighting. They did this in September last year in Kherson, and the net result was that the Russian garrison had to withdraw from Kherson because Russia simply couldn't supply it any longer. If they can do this in the areas that they want to target, for example, around Melitopol or wherever it may be, then there's a chance that they can avoid some of the huge casualties they're otherwise going to face.
In the past 3 days, Mr. Zelensky has been in Italy, Germany, France, and now the UK. How do you assess the success of this tour?
I think it is successful, but Ukraine's Western allies are somewhat holding their breath, waiting to see how and when this great promised spring-summer offensive. I mean, every day we talk about this, it's getting closer to summer and further away from spring. So, you know, when this offensive happens, it's got to succeed, because if we're still having the same conversation a year from now and the battle lines haven't moved much and the pink areas of Russian-occupied Ukraine are largely the same on the map as they are today, then I don't think there's going to be much Western appetite to keep sustaining it at this level. The pressure on President Zelensky is going to be enormous to reach a deal with Russia. And that will be a deal on Russia's terms, which is unacceptable to him politically, so his government could well collapse and so on. That's not what the West wants. So verbally, they're saying we'll do whatever it takes. But I don't think voters are going to be able to have an indefinite amount of patience on this. So time is on President Putin's side in the long term. But militarily, I would say the advantage is with Ukraine right now. The question is, what do they do with it and when?
Frank Gardner. In a separate development concerning Ukraine, South Africa's military has confirmed that the commander of its ground forces is in Moscow for talks. This comes days after the United States accused President Cyril Ramaphosa's government of secretly providing weapons to Russia. Here's Will Ross.
News that South Africa's army chief was in Moscow for talks initially came from Russian news agencies. The opposition Democratic Alliance described the visit as shameful and accused President Cyril Ramaphosa of lying when he said the country was neutral in the war between Russia and Ukraine. The US accusation that arms were secretly given to Russia has also cast some doubt on Pretoria's policy of being non-aligned. South Africa's National Defence Force sought to downplay the Moscow meeting, saying the trip was planned well in advance. The ANC, which was strongly backed by Russia during the apartheid years, now finds itself walking a tightrope, trying to appease Washington and Moscow.
Will Ross. A four-year inquiry has strongly criticised the FBI for the way it investigated allegations of collusion between Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and Russia. The long-awaited report by special counsel who was appointed by the Trump administration said the FBI began investigating without having any verified intelligence that Mr. Trump had conspired with Moscow. Our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told us more about the findings.
Well, this is a report by John Durham, who is an attorney, a US attorney, or was. And he was appointed, as you say, by under the Trump administration to look into the connection and the way the FBI had initiated this investigation. And Donald Trump, and indeed his attorney general, hoped that it would uncover a kind of deep state conspiracy, an attempt to derail the Trump campaign before the 2016 election. Now, John Durham has criticised the FBI strongly. He said that there's been severe reputational harm done. But his investigations actually only resulted in two criminal prosecutions, both of which were acquitted. Both men were acquitted. And one mid-level FBI lawyer who admitted his guilt for tampering with an email. So it didn't really undermine or unpick this sort of deep state conspiracy that Donald Trump thought it would. Though, of course, the former president has grasped upon this report today and said that it proves the American people have been scammed.
Not a surprising reaction from Donald Trump. And we've also had reaction from the FBI.
Yeah, the FBI have acknowledged that there were missteps in this investigation. And indeed, a Department of Justice Inspector General, while he said there'd been no political bias, he said there had been some missteps. And the FBI says it's put some of those things right, the way it applies for wiretaps and things like that. So they are putting their hands up to some problems. I think the difficulty, of course, is that this was meant to be part of a sort of wider conspiracy with the intelligence services and others in political life. That's what Donald Trump hoped to get out of this, and that has not been demonstrated. And in some ways, the Inspector General and John Durham are at odds with their description of the way the FBI started their investigations in the first place.
Gary O'Donoghue. Well, staying in the United States, it had seemed at the end of last year that the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, was the front runner to become the Republican candidate for the U.S. presidential election next year. But polls are now swinging back behind Donald Trump, despite a slew of legal cases against him. Nevertheless, Mr. DeSantis is expected to announce his run for the U.S. presidency in the coming weeks. And he's been campaigning across a key state, Iowa, which will be the first to vote. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, was in Iowa to watch what he's up to.
Lord, we thank you for today. We thank you for our great country and our great state.
It's all faith, flag, and freedom at this lunchtime event in rural Sioux City, Iowa.
We pray for those you may be raising up to lead in these vital roles. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.
There's about 600 people, mostly Republicans, who've come here to take the measure of Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, who has not yet declared that he's running for president, but there isn't really any other reason why he would be here in Iowa.
Please let's stand up and welcome Governor Ron DeSantis to this great state of Iowa.
I think if you look around the country, you see a lot of reason for pessimism. But I think what both Iowa and Florida show Republicans across the country, that Republicans can win again and can win big.
One of Ron DeSantis' campaign slogans that's already appearing on badges and T-shirts is Make America Florida. He's proud of the very conservative policies he's recently introduced. A six-week abortion ban, don't say gay rules in schools, and loosening gun laws. He also worked in some swipes at Donald Trump, who is miles ahead of Ron DeSantis in the polls and currently the clear frontrunner.
And at the end of the day, governing is not about entertaining. Governing is not about building a brand or talking on social media and virtue signaling. It's ultimately about winning and about producing results. And that's what you've done in Iowa, and that's what we've done in Florida.
Well, Ron DeSantis is getting a standing ovation from this conservative crowd here. They loved him talking about closing the U.S. border and declaring what he called his war on woke. But has he won their votes? Do the people in this room think they were listening to the next president of the United States?
Yeah. I'm a DeSantis fan. I voted for Trump. I like Trump, but I think DeSantis represents kind of more Northwest Iowa family cultural values.
What did you think? Did Ron DeSantis win your vote?
Yeah, I think so. Everything I heard, I agreed with. He has leadership record as governor, and I feel like Trump is a little too divisive.
I'm still undecided, but he did a nice job. He's a very good speaker.
So you still thinking you might support Donald Trump?
Possibly, yes. I haven't decided, though.
In a Republican red apron, flipping burgers on a huge barbecue after his speech, Ron DeSantis was happy to pose for the cameras, but so far he has given very few interviews. And as reporters crowded around,
how are you going to get ahead of Donald Trump when he's so far ahead of you in the polls?
No answer, just a bit of a smirk as he strode away. Luckily, Erin Perini, the communications director for Never Back Down, a pro-DeSantis campaign group, was around to answer questions. Governor DeSantis had great victory in the midterm elections. He has a long list of legislative achievements since then. So why is he still up to 40 points behind Donald Trump in the polls?
Well, I would point to the national head-to-heads. When it comes to Republicans wanting to win in November 2024, it's very clear who they need to choose, and that is Governor DeSantis. And right now, he's not an announced candidate, but he is still very clearly made this a two-man race before he is in it. That is the enthusiasm. And Republicans, I think, if the governor decides to get in, are really going to be excited when they get to know more about the man.
Ron DeSantis does have the distinction of being the Republican most frequently attacked by Donald Trump.
The problem with Ron DeSanctimonious is that he needs a personality transplant, and those are not yet available.
Mr. Trump was scheduled to hold a rally in Iowa on the same day Ron DeSantis was here. He cancelled, citing tornado warnings.
Thank you all for coming out.
So the Florida governor deliberately popped up right by Trump's abandoned venue and got in another dig.
Beautiful night. It's been a great day for us.
No tornadoes appeared, by the way.
I think Florida and Iowa are a source of hope because we show you can get it done.
For a man who has not yet declared that he's running for president.
You know, we're going to have a chance pretty soon to make sure that's done in every state in this country.
He really hasn't left much room for doubt. Ron DeSantis is expected to formally launch his campaign in the next few weeks.
That report by Sarah Smith in the US state of Iowa. The most valuable deal in gaming history has cleared a major hurdle after gaining the approval of European Union regulators. Microsoft's $69 billion takeover of Activision Blizzard requires permission from the EU, the United States and Britain to go ahead. But regulators in the US and the UK are objecting to the deal, saying Microsoft might make Activision Blizzard's games exclusive to its own cloud gaming service, harming competition. Activision Blizzard publishes some of the world's most popular game franchises, including Call of Duty. Ben Thompson heard more from our gaming correspondent Stefan Powell about these concerns.
If you imagine Netflix or Disney Plus or Amazon Prime, all of these streaming services that we're used to using in sort of television and movie land, well, if you apply that principle but to video games, the idea being that you could play any game on any device that you want, whether it's your phone, whether it's a console or a high-end PC, and cloud gaming services are offering this. This is the promise of perhaps the future of gaming. And Microsoft, who are currently losing, you could argue, in the console market, the current way where we buy games, where you go out, you spend 50, 60, 70 quid on a game and you put it into your high-powered console and that's your experience for a few weeks or a few months. The idea with cloud gaming is that you can access any game at any time. And Microsoft are betting on this future. At the moment, it's only 1% of the overall gaming market. But they think this is the direction of travel, and so they're gambling, if you will, $69 billion to be in a good position to have enough content so that if people end up doing streaming in the game service in a meaningful way in the future, that they're going to be the front runners. And so the EU have said, I tell you what, we've looked at your remedies and we've thought that the way that you're going to make it work is perfectly fine and balanced in a competition sense, so we're going to allow you to have this takeover. But like you said, plenty of hurdles to go before this finally gets approved. So that's the idea of cloud gaming, and that's why it's become such a hot topic when it comes to this acquisition. A couple of months ago, Ben, not many people were talking about cloud gaming services. Now it's the big discussion point in the games industry.
Yeah, it shows how quickly things are changing, doesn't it? And Stefan, given that what now the EU has said yes, Japan has said yes, the UK and the US so far saying no, do you think the idea that the EU approving this will give Microsoft the clout it needs to appeal against that US verdict?
Yeah, I think it is a significant decision today because it's basically the second act of a three-act play, if you will, when it comes to this deal, because the three main ones they need to worry about are the UK, the EU and the US. If the deal is not passed in those three territories, then it's curtains for this deal and it comes to an end. So, like you say, in the US, it works slightly differently. The deal is approved unless it is blocked. And so the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission in America, have got to take this to court in order to block it. And so that will happen later on in the summer. Whereas slightly differently in the EU and in the UK, it has to be approved first. And we've seen it be approved here in the EU. And what this does is that it places pressure on the UK's decision, the Competition and Markets Authority's decision a few weeks ago, to block the deal. Because we're expecting Microsoft and Activision to appeal that decision. And so this decision will allow them to give them, well, a bit more scope to ensure that appeal is successful. That can take quite a long time. It might be quite a lengthy process. We might not find out what happens with that appeal until later on this year. So they have to have those three territories to approve. They've got one down. One's a very serious question mark. And the other one currently is a no. And they're trying to overturn that decision. And we'll get more details on that appeal in the coming weeks.
Stefan Powell. Two Austrian men have been charged after speeches by the former Nazi leader Adolf Hitler were allegedly played on a train's loudspeaker system. There was also audio of shouts of Heil Hitler and Sieg Heil as the intercity train approached Vienna. The police tracked the suspects down using video. Spreading Nazi propaganda is a criminal offence in Austria. Bethany Bell reports.
One passenger told the BBC the Hitler recording was played over the intercom shortly before the train arrived in Vienna. The passenger, David Stergmüller, a Green Party MP, said he first heard 30 seconds of the Hitler speech and then the crowd shouting Sieg Heil. He said the staff were unable to stop the audio and that everyone on the train was completely shocked. Austrian Railways, the ÖBB, said there have been several such incidents in recent days.
Bethany Bell. Still to come.
It's a very luxurious plane. It has 80 seats. It has mahogany furnishings. It's got a presidential bedroom with an ensuite bathroom.
For sale, a second-hand presidential jet. But why was it so hard to find a buyer? We'll be back right after this.
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
Fukushima, a new audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
The radiation is here. It's everywhere.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The main challenger in Turkey's presidential election has urged his supporters not to fall into despair after the first round gave the incumbent Recep Tayyip Erdogan a clear lead. He got 5 percentage points more than Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. The two men will now face each other in a runoff vote in 2 weeks. An international monitoring group, the OSCE, praised the high turnout and political choice offered to Turkish voters, but it said biased media coverage had given Mr. Erdogan an unfair advantage. These voters gave their view.
I was quite disappointed by yesterday's election results, so I'm not really hopeful for the runoff elections now, for the second round. I think Erdogan will win that as well. Erdogan's party has lost around 10% of its vote, and I think Erdogan's side is more divided than ever now.
I'm happy because President Erdogan, I think, still the only one who I can trust on the national and international level. And I think still President Erdogan has a huge stance on Turkish national interests. That's why I supported him.
So why did President Erdogan do so much better than opinion polls had predicted? A question for our correspondent in Istanbul, Johnny Diamond.
The cynical ones would say, here is a man who has, either directly or through proxies, control of nearly all of the media, who has imprisoned opposition figures and opposition voices, who has, through the judiciary, launched hundreds of thousands of investigations into people for the crime of insulting the president, who has, through state patronage, been able to spray money around in the months before this election, and with those advantages has managed to defy the dire economic conditions here in Turkey. Inflation is at least 50%. Most people think it's much higher than that. The currency is all over the place, and has managed to pull out a victory. But there is more to it than just that. There is also the very deep well of support that he has across the country. I mean, outside in particular of the big cities, once you get into the great Anatolian plain, there is great support for him, and particularly amongst more devout Muslims. There is the fact that he reflects the nationalism that runs pretty deep in Turkey. And there is the fact that this is a really quite badly polarized society, a really rather divided society where two blocks dislike each other pretty intensely, and no one is really in a mood to change their mind about it. And so support is relatively static.
So what can we extrapolate from the first round to say how the second one will go?
Well, I mean, I'd go out on a limb and say it looks pretty good for Recep Tayyip Erdogan, for the sitting president. He is 5 points ahead, which is a good chunk of the population. But I think it will be very difficult for the opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, to make up that gap.
And what would another Erdogan victory mean for Turkey and for its allies, particularly the West?
Nearly everyone has agreed that there is no sign of Recep Tayyip Erdogan loosening what is a very tight grip on Turkey. He has centralised enormous power around himself and around the presidency that he holds. He runs what is widely acknowledged to be a repressive and autocratic regime where freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom to demonstrate is brutally squeezed. I mean, the country has transformed from, say, 10 or 15 years ago. As far as the alliances are concerned, they'll probably stay as they are, and they are curious. You know, on the one hand, Turkey is a big seller of drones to Ukraine. On the other, the relationship between President Erdogan and Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, is very strong indeed. So it's very difficult to call how things will develop, but there are certainly considerable numbers of Turks, young, more liberal Turks today, very, very unhappy about how the election has turned out. Many have contemplated leaving the country, some more will. And we wait to see what will happen with the economy, because the challenge of inflation has been almost entirely brought about by the president's own rather unorthodox economic policy of holding interest rates down while inflation rises, something condemned by nearly every economist around the world. So interesting times ahead for Turkey, and challenging times ahead for those who value freedom of speech and freedom of expression.
Johnny Diamond. It's a dramatic fall for a media company that once boasted a near $6 billion evaluation. The Vice Media Group has filed for bankruptcy in the United States after failing to monetize the appeal of assets like Vice News and Vice TV to younger viewers. And it could now be sold for the cut price of $225 million. Our business reporter, Daniel Thomas, has more details.
Specializing in edgy, youth-focused content, Vice was once seen as part of a vanguard of companies set to disrupt the traditional media landscape. In 2012, Rupert Murdoch tipped the group for global success, tweeting that it was speaking to millennials who don't read or watch established media. But despite expanding into more than 30 countries, the publishers struggled to turn critical acclaim to profit, losing out to Google and Facebook in the race for digital advertising revenue.
Daniel Thomas. A luxury presidential plane, which Mexico had been trying to offload for more than 4 years, has finally arrived in its new home, Tajikistan. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador made the sale of the Boeing 787 Dreamliner one of his campaign promises, but has struggled to find a buyer until now. Our Latin American online editor, Vanessa Buschluter, told us more about the saga of the unwanted luxury plane.
This plane was actually made for a previous Mexican president. It was commissioned by Felipe Calderón in 2012, but it wasn't finished until 2016. And then it served for many years Enrique Peña Nieto, who was president at the time. And what the current president says is that this plane is a symbol of the excesses of those previous administrations. It's a very luxurious plane. It has 80 seats, which is very few for a jet of that size. It has mahogany furnishings. It's got a presidential bedroom with an ensuite bathroom. And President Andrés Manuel López Obrador argued that he, who is a left-wing president, some call him a populist, doesn't need such trappings of office. And so when he came to the presidency, the day after he was sworn in, he put it up for sale.
So why has it proved so hard to shift?
Because it has so few seats, it is actually a very expensive plane per passenger to run. And of course, it burns huge amounts of fuel. And storing it is a bit of a nightmare as well because of its size. It's a Dreamliner, so it's a massive jet. And nobody wanted it.
So he must be very relieved to have finally got rid of it. What do we know about how it will be used in the future?
He has sold it to Tajikistan, but we don't know what it will be used for exactly. It was sold for $92 million, which is a lot less than the $218 million that it originally cost. But of course, after all of these years, I think the Mexican president and most Mexicans are just relieved to see the back of it.
Vanessa Buschluter. Is a Nigerian chef about to poach the world cooking record? Hilda Bassi has been cooking non-stop for 4 days and four nights in an attempt to break the Guinness World Record, with her supporters egging her on. My colleague James Reynolds spoke to Nkechi Ogbonna, who was at the cookathon, as the chef reached her goal of 96 hours.
There is a lot of excitement here. You can hear the crowds in the background cheering, chanting Chef Bassi to victory. And she initially set a 96-hour mark, but in a shocking twist of events, once that countdown reached 96 hours, Chef Bassi has decided to stretch it to 100 hours.
Wow.
And this is incredible.
What is she cooking?
She has been cooking several dishes, and notable among them are the popular jollof rice, which is very popular in this part of the world. And of course, thanks to social media, is now a global phenomenon. She has made several Nigerian dishes and continental dishes as well.
I'm looking at her on the social media feed. I can see her in her apron behind the counter. She's been going for 96 hours. How does she look to you? Has she got enough energy to carry on the next 4 hours?
She's currently dancing and singing. Several musicians have come here. There is a DJ set here and encouraging her. She looks tired, but she's had a mix of emotions. Last night I was here, you could tell that the fatigue had set in and she was really exhausted. She shed a few tears yesterday, actually. But today, she's in high spirits, probably because she can smell the finish line. And so this is incredible to witness.
I can see some of her dancing on the live feed. Do you know, Nkechi, why Chef Bassi is doing this?
Well, Chef Bassi is a notable chef in Nigeria. She owns an online business where she cooks and delivers meals to people as well from her restaurant. And so rather than doing the ordinary, I spoke to a team member of hers earlier who says she's doing this not just for herself, but for Nigerian culture. She wants the narrative of Nigerian culinary delicacies to be global. And so this means a lot to her, but above all, means a great deal to the entire culinary industry in the country.
It's so fascinating watching her. She's been measuring ingredients. She stopped to dance. I think she's waving at some of the fans outside. Who gets to eat the food that she's been cooking? Because presumably for 96 hours, that's an awful lot of food.
Yeah, it's an awful lot of food, I tell you. And so lots of the crowds here, the spectators are mostly Nigerian young population. The youth are here in their thousands. And so those who are lucky enough to be at the front, just after the barricade where Chef Bassi is cooking from, get to taste a lot of her meal. But aside that, the excitement that she's cooking and people are watching her and they are chanting and cheering her to victory just keeps her going.
Nkechi Ogbonna in Nigeria. Guinness World Records is now reviewing the evidence before it decides whether Chef Bassi has broken the previous record for non-stop cooking, which was set by another chef, Lata Tondon, in India. She made meals for 87 hours and 45 minutes, another phenomenal achievement. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
In March 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a massive tsunami. It plunged Japan into the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are at the war! An invisible enemy is trying to occupy Japan!
Fukushima, an original 7-part audio drama from the BBC World Service, telling the story of the heroes who fought to contain the disaster.
Our job is clear. To cool the reactors, you'll be risking your life to save Japan.
And of those living with its impact.
I'm connected to the disaster. I'll never be able to separate myself from it.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.